Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Okay. Can I start by welcoming you all to St. Angela's College this morning? I'm sorry it's such a misty morning and that you can't see the lake, but so be it. In February, we can't expect an awful lot more, I guess. So I just want to thank you all for your presence here today, for coming to the lecture which is titled Religious Education, Faith Formation and Intercultural Dialogue, which has been delivered this morning by Dr. Leonardo Franchi from the University of Glasgow. And in particular, I want to extend a very warm welcome to Dr. Franchi to St. Angela's College and to thank him for taking the time to be with us here today and to share his wonderful experience and wisdom with us. So, Cad Mila Falchalath, Gudji Kalashta Sanangal, and you. Those of you present here today, those of you present here today will have already seen the short biography on Professor Franchi that was circulated prior to this event. And you will understand from that that Professor Franchi has made a significant contribution to the field of religious education in the Catholic education tradition. He has extensive experience of teaching in schools and at both undergraduate and postgraduate level. He has wide research interests, including the philosophy and practice of contemporary Catholic education, intercultural dialogue in religious education, the role of liberal arts in contemporary education, the history of Christian education, especially models of formation in early Christianity, and initial teacher education in the contemporary university. So as you can see, Professor Franchi brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the field of education. So without further ado, I will now hand you over to Dr. Franchi for what I know will be a very exciting and informative lecture this morning. So thank you.
Thank you for your very kind and very warm words of welcome. I begin simply by asking you to make sure that you understand the accent. Yes, yes, yes. This is not an Irish accent, it's not an English accent. Despite the Italian name, the accent is Scottish. We have many Scots Italians in Scotland, and I come from that particular community. And I come often to Ireland, but this, I must say, is the first time I've been in Sligo, and I was greeted this morning with some mist and rain, so I feel really much at home. Yeah. The slide behind me is the main building of the University of Glasgow, where we often move around. That is where our students have their final examinations and where they have graduations. It's the centerpiece of our ancient university. The University of Glasgow actually dates back to 1451. It's one of three universities in Scotland, the other two being Aberdeen and St. Andrews, which predate the Reformation. So we have an ancient history of university education in our country. That's often forgotten, but it's just to remind people that we have this long tradition of scholarship. Now, in choosing the title for today, there are three terms here: religious education, faith formation, and intercultural dialogue. Three terms really which have huge fields behind them, and many of you, to a greater or lesser extent, will be involved in studying these topics. For those of you who are entering the profession, these are words, terms, which are very much part of your mindset when you think of education today, when you think of religious education. Words like formation and dialogue should be at the forefront of your studies. For those of you who have been, let's say, through the system for a couple of years, these words never leave us, and how we understand them can change from context to context. So the focus today is to look at this from three sections, to look broadly at the connections we can find between religious education in the Catholic tradition and this concept of intercultural dialogue. We will then try to explore the idea of RE as an invitation to explore a long and established tradition or traditions. And then we will conclude by just considering again some of the key pillars of faith formation in contemporary Catholicism, contemporary Christianity. That's the plan. As you know, if you're doing lesson planning, what do people always tell you when you're doing a lesson plan? What's one of the things you have to remember?
They can all go pear-shaped. Yeah, that word pear-shaped is like, oh, great. Things can go pear-shaped because events can happen. So I am very open to the idea that people could ask questions at some point. So we might go on a tangent at some points, and sometimes tangents are good things to do. But the first thing we'll do is put the microphone back in its proper place. Don't think it should have fallen down like that. That's better. And let's begin. You can just see. This is the opening card in our debates on the intersection between religious education and intercultural dialogue. And the source of this document is at the bottom of the page. It's from this body in Rome called the Congregation for Catholic Education. And the function of this congregation in Rome is to do lots of things. Looking after Catholic education worldwide is the broad aim. But on a practical level, they issue lots and lots of documents. Sometimes people read them. Sometimes people want to read them. But this one that came out in 2013 is a rather long document. It's called Educating to Intercultural Dialogue in Catholic Schools, Living in Harmony for a Civilization of Love. It would be great to close your eyes and repeat that title, but nobody can remember it. It's so long. It's a long document. And it's so long, it could actually take you two or three coffees to read it. You know, it's such a long document. But we are not going to read the whole thing today, and it's not the expectation. But what we're going to do is just zoom in on a couple of aspects which arise from this. Because we are living today in a situation both in Ireland and in the UK where some would argue that the nature of Catholic education is under significant pressure. The shape of education is always changing. We know that from history. Things never really stay the same. We think they do, but they don't. But the fundamentals are often there. So when we look at terms like intercultural dialogue, we can't say it so often. We exhaust ourselves with saying it and don't take the time to ponder what it could mean for our sort of living and teaching context. What does it mean for you as you go into a school experience placement, for example? How does RE and how does intercultural dialogue affect things like your lesson planning? The type of resources you're going to be using in a classroom, how you deal with the teachers and the students and the children in your classroom. So these are big themes, and this particular aspect of it comes through. The word there which I would focus on is in the second bottom line. It's the word dialogue. Dialogue remains the only possible solution, even when faced with the denial of religious sentiment, with atheism and agnosticism. So the call there is to foster an awareness of the value of dialogue, not to close doors, not to assume that progress cannot be made, but to approach all manner of situations with a sense of hope. That dialogue, what we are doing this morning is dialogue. What you do in schools can be often dialogue. And there's all the informal dialogues you do over coffee and over tea when you share lesson experiences and tell, this went well, whatnot. That's dialogue. And we can make that more formal. But as a concept, education is a dialogue across the generations and across traditions as we share this treasure of humanity. So we have to put flesh on those bones, and to look at the second point here, to what extent do Catholic theological and intellectual traditions invite dialogue within and beyond the church? So an expectation there is that we build our store of knowledge through this ongoing dialogue with people of our own tradition, but also with people who are maybe coming from other perspectives, other standpoints, trying to find ways in which we can explore common ground. Clearly, with cultural shifts, some have argued that the role of the Catholic school is changing, that it is no longer, if it ever was, some would say, a school simply for Catholics, but it's a school where all people are invited to study in the spirit of the Catholic tradition. What does that mean? We'll come back to that later on, but certainly it's the whole idea that we have something
to offer educationally, which goes beyond the concept of formation in faith, which is not to be denied, but the educational traditions are there. Now, when we look at the history of Christianity, from the very beginnings of the church, we can see that what we would call today education was part of the lifeblood of those communities. That where Christians came together, they were intent on telling other people their story, or their stories. We read that about that in the Acts of the Apostles. That's a great adventure story. Really, that's one way of looking at the Acts. It's an adventure tale of these people leaving the things they knew and going into other cultures and exploring things, explaining things, getting shipwrecked here and there and everywhere, coming across persecutions, etc. It's a wonderful tale in that sense. But it's a tale driven by faith. It's by the desire to move on and preach and proclaim, often through dialogue. And as the church, the early Christians, became more cohesive in how they understood education, we encounter people like St. Augustine of Hippo, who begins to develop an understanding of education in a more philosophical way. And he's very quotable. But for Augustine, he saw all education as a formation in Christ. And he has some very interesting things to say about the role of the teacher. And I often use this with the students that, and the quote is, it's a great quote. Why go to school to find out what the teacher thinks? Eh? Ponder that one. Why go to school to find out what the teacher thinks? What he's not doing there is saying that teachers are unimportant. What he's saying is the role of the teacher is to point beyond him or herself towards the ultimate truth. And some of the commentaries on Augustine would summarize his position as teaching is the act of pointing. Pointing to what? Pointing to the truth, capital T, which for the Christian is the divine person of Jesus Christ. So we have this idea already in the first centuries of a developing philosophy of education, an idea or ideas underpinning what we do. And that often can contrast with the political drive, the cultural drives which we have in contemporary society, where education is often seen as explicitly no more than a preparation for employment. Now, I'm not denying that's important, but for the Christian, the whole idea of moral human formation is the ground rock, is everything there, is from there. So we have that aspect of education, which, if you look at this, the final point there, it suggests the Catholic school has got a vision of education to which all are invited, but also ensures that human formation, cultural formation, is the driving force, the lifeblood, not just the skills and the knowledge you need in order to go into the employment market or to do particular tasks. And that is the key, or one of the keys to the Christian understanding of education. You may have been heard that last year there was what's called a synod of the bishops of the church. A synod is a big meeting. And for a number of weeks and months, there was a series of discussions and debates. Some of you may have contributed to these things through questionnaires from your diocese. But the final document came out quite recently, like a summary document, what you would call, as you would call as a student, a long essay. And this long essay, it was a very long essay actually, is worth reading again. One of the great things about technology today is all these great church documents should be accessible at the click of a button or two. You don't need to go and buy them. But in this document on the Synod of Bishops on Young People, which should be informed really by many of the perspectives of young people and their representatives, this is what has been said. And I don't often like to quote from slides because we can all read them, but this is actually quite important. The church's educational institutions seek to welcome all young people, irrespective of their religious choices, their cultural origins, and their personal, family, or social situation. So in contemporary educational language, that is very much the language of inclusion. that no one is excluded, obviously, but that it's in quite bold terms in a small section on education. In this way, the church makes a fundamental contribution to the integral education of the young in many different parts of the world. And the focus there is on integral education, i.e. not just the preparation for work, the development of particular skills. All of that should be sort of caught up in this idea of a cultural formation, a human formation. And we see in the second half of the quote that it's not just about schools, it's about professional formation in colleges and universities, youth centres and oratories, and the welcome given to refugees and social engagement. All of these are seen as forms of education. So it reminds us that the commitment to education goes far beyond what happens in the primary and the secondary school or the university or college. It's about a way of being which wants to see the formation of the human person as our driving force, be it in a school, be it in a centre, be it in an oratory, or even in a youth club or a chaplaincy. All of that is very much in the field of education. And I'm sure you're aware of that, but it's good to have the reminders from these documents that when we do these sorts of things, they are not ancillary to our main body, they are part and parcel of what we are doing. Okay, so let's look at the second question. This is going to be fixed again. And just to consider this notion of religious education in particular as an invitation. The saint there, he looks quite young and beatific, there is Saint Thomas Aquinas, whom you may have heard of, who was born not far from a small village in Italy where my own father was born. So I feel as if I own a part of him. And he is one of these guys who seemed, there's lots of quotes from him as well, that seemingly he said that to be happy you need two things. What do you think the two things would be? Any talking of dialogue, who can start the dialogue? Hmm? You think God, are you very religious? Yes, yes. I'm sure he said at one point, God's important. I'm sure he did. I'm sure he said that at one point, yeah, I'm sure he did. But he also allegedly said, to be happy, you need a warm bath and good red wine. So there you are. So. God gives you the wine and the hot water. So whether that's true or not, there are various quotes. I mean, if it's not true, well, it should be true. You know, it's a very human way of looking. A hot bath and red wine, you're off and running. So that's for all those who are out to a school practice, the night before your school practice, never mind your lesson planning, get a hot bath and a glass of something hot. And you'll do very well. So, and say, Aquinas said I can do this. So, let's think of this now. Religious education. What is religious education? Now, again, if I were to put a piece of paper round and ask you to give a one or two line definition of RE, we would get lots and lots of answers, most of which would be on the right lines and similar. Yep, so it's one of these fields where it's a game we could play. What's your definition of RE? And what I'm giving here is not by no means the only one or the best one. It's an offering to the banquet. But the key thing we've got to bear in mind is religious education in the school, as a school subject, has got a focus, must have a focus on knowledge of Christian traditions. Okay? That's really what makes it different from the other subjects. But they're combining the idea of the importance of knowledge with a base. Okay? Knowledge base. Now, it's inviting people to have what's called a critical encounter or exploration with Catholic thinking. Not just to play around with the words, but just to consider what that means for contemporary culture. So the RE time frame on the school timetable is not the only place and should not be the only place where God or religion is mentioned. Of course not. In a Catholic school, the Catholic culture should be at the heart of what we do and say. But in the that slot, that hour or so, whenever it may be, when RE is there, or I think you can maybe call it religion here sometime, is systematically to explore, to critique this set of inherited religious traditions and practices that we call Catholicism. What are they? What do they mean? Why do we have them? Why do we do these things in the way in which we do them? And that is something which can be explored by people of all traditions. You don't have to be a Catholic to explore Catholic theology or to explore Catholic ideas. It's an invitation to study, to think, to consider, to ponder, and to see, where are these things coming from? In what way have they shaped our community? In what way have they shaped your country and other countries? In what way do they shape or not shape legislation for parliaments, for the European Union, for the United Nations? To what extent does this whole worldview play a part in civic and public life? That sounds quite a grand curriculum, because it is a grand curriculum. And each stage of the school, you might only be doing a small part of it. But when you stop and look back over the piece, we should be able to detect a long, systematic view of this. Now, the term critical exploration is worthy of some comment. Often we hear the word critical almost as an invitation to dissent, or just to be opposed to things, to come to things from another perspective, really to stir things up. And there can be a place for that. We need people to stir us up all the time. But essentially, a critical exploration, really, we are asking ourselves to go deeper into the subject area, to really ask ourselves, well, why has this been said this way? And the reason why I put Aquinas as one of the models is he actually did that. And the method which he employed was basically to take a point of Christian doctrine and then to set out the case against it. So if you want arguments against Catholicism, you go to Aquinas. But then he argues in favour of it against what he's arguing himself. So you see the method. He's saying, well, here's what I believe, really, but on the other hand, it could be... Then he says, then he jumps into the other side and he'll argue against himself. And he comes to the conclusion, what's called the synthesis, where he shows things. Now, as a way of doing education, so to speak, not just in religion, there is a lot to be said for that, to explore things from wider perspectives, to challenge your own thinking, to ask people to challenge your own thinking. We see that in parliamentary systems across the UK and elsewhere, that the whole point of having an opposition is to oppose. That's the whole point. They're opposing the government, so the government should be able to think through its policies in a better way. That's the theory anyway. Okay, this idea of when somebody's coming to you with the opposing view, you have to learn to think through your own position quite strongly. So Aquinas does that very subtly with lots of nuance. And for that reason, and for other reasons too, he has a very strong place in the list of those people we draw upon in Catholic thinking today. So even though he wasn't born yesterday, it's back in the 13th century, he's still very much part of contemporary debates today. So let's also think now, bring it a bit more up to date, and consider this idea of invitation and give it a particular context. And this context was one formulated about 10 years ago now by Pope Benedict. And it was all part of a desire, I believe, in Pope Benedict to engage in dialogue with people of other traditions. As an academic himself, he was well used to the idea that he would come to seminars and he would present ideas and people would give other views and he would try to debate and find a way forward. Now, this notion here, which I find personally quite attractive, was based on the design of the temple in Jerusalem. And that's one possible representation. And in this design, there was a space for the Gentiles, i.e. the non-Jewish people. And that space was there to encourage them to get access to the temple, but a limited access, right? They were brought into the debate, but only so far physically. And what Pope Benedict formulated, and it grew some quite substantial arms and legs for a couple of years there, was to see this idea of the court or the courtyard of the Gentiles as a way of strengthening dialogue, principally with those from an atheist tradition, those who did not believe in God. He felt that this idea of Christians engaging in dialogue with those who did not believe was worth pursuing. And he sort of christened it or baptized it as the court of the Gentiles by inviting people from that tradition to seminars, to symposia, with a view to exploring their views with him and others, not just him, and seeing that as the beginnings of a journey of faith. His view would be that by actually taking part in the dialogue, people were showing good faith. That was it. By turning up to take part in dialogue, good, we've made progress. And that was actually quite a significant move. Now, again, there'll be websites on how it's developed, and there were various. I think the first was in Paris. I think Paris was chosen because of for historical reasons, as the place where there were a lot of ideas against Catholicism. So by going to that sort of base of Paris and other locations, Pope Benedict did have an impact on that kind of debate. Pope Francis has used another term, and the term Pope Francis used is the culture of encounter. And if we unpack what Pope Francis says when he talks of the culture of encounter, essentially it's the same thing as this, I would say. It's the encounter with people, not just of our own, but of other traditions, and in that encounter, trying to find ways forward. I have a great friend back in the UK who was instrumental in forming a group called Catholic Voices, and I think here in Ireland they're called Catholic Comment. And the basic philosophy around this, if we can call it philosophy, is that when Christians engage in dialogue with people of other traditions, those who might be hostile to Christianity, his view would be that it's important to find a connecting point. And his view would be that even in those who are very hostile to Christianity, if you are patient, you will find a Christian value behind what they're saying. And when you've found that Christian value, you hook onto that. Then you build a friendship and you keep the debate and the dialogue going. So this notion of encounter, of dialogue, is a way of coming from the recent popes. So it's not from left field. So it's from Benedict, it's from Francis. Is a way of showing how the church can, in a sense, evangelize or proclaim its mission in a culture where it might not often be seen to be the authority. Now, let's just see what Pope Francis says about dialogue. And this was a talk he gave to the congregation in 2017. And it's a plenary meeting of this congregation, and the popes are usually invited to give a few words. So he did. And again, we have lucky to have the whole text on the Vatican website. And he then gives us, as you can see, a very strong reflection on how to have dialogue. And have one, two, fourth line down. We are encouraged by the conviction that the new generations educated in a Christian way to dialogue will come out of the school and university classrooms motivated to build bridges and hence to find new answers to the many challenges of our time. In a more specific sense, the schools and the universities and the colleges and elsewhere are called to teach, I love this phrase, a method of intellectual dialogue geared to the search for truth. So what we have there is a one paragraph, you could say, summary of the whole question of a method And if we want to find examples of that method, we go back to Aquinas by looking at your own position. We go back to Augustine, for example, pointing things towards the truth. Because for the Christ, truth is a person, not a set of abstract ideas or values, but a divine living person. And Francis, Pope Francis, is very much aware of that. So we have that there as something to encourage us in our work, in our work in schools, when we go into the school, when we teach religious education, when we have that privilege of leading a class, and not just in RE, but in all sorts of things. You are, as a teacher, for example, very much a person who is part of the dialogue. And this search for truth, this joint search, this collegial search for truth and meaning, is a sense not new. It's what the Christian community has been doing since the days of the first believers. So far, so good. Let's go on to our third part. And pillars of faith formation. The first thing to bear in mind is that our faith is formed not by our own efforts. Okay, that's important. It's so important that we often think that through hard work we can achieve everything. Well, we need to work hard. It's a divine calling. But we need to be aware of the temptation of thinking that simply through our efforts alone, we will achieve all the things we need to know and do. That is not a Christian view. We do so in response to what's called divine grace, divine guidance. So not just our faith formation, the actor here is the Holy Spirit. But that doesn't absolve us of the responsibility to use the human means to study and to find opportunities for formation. We can't just say, I'm leaving it all to the Holy Spirit and go and do nothing. That'd be easy. Now, I've thrown up the picture of the Catechism of the Catholic Church there, bearing in mind that the Catechism, when we look through the Catechism, is full of references to Scripture. Because it's Scripture which is the soul of our formation. We take that as grand for granted. We take that as read and maybe for granted sometime as well. But when we read the footnotes and the end, all the different add-ons to the Catechism, we have many, many examples and references to the Gospels and to the other parts of the Scriptures. And that should always be our first port of call for inspiration, for guidance. That goes without saying. The Catechism sets out for us today what the tradition of the Church is with regard to our doctrine under these four pillars. These four pillars are the traditional way in which Christianity has formulated its mission in terms of doctrine. That from early times, these are the four parts of the catechetical picture. The profession of faith, essentially, the creed. Well, we have more than one creed, but the idea of the creed as the statement of Christian doctrine. The second part is the celebration of the Christian mystery, the liturgy, how we understand the Mass and the sacraments, crucial. Life in Christ is about moral life, moral virtues, living in that way, and Christian prayer is Christian prayer. That's what it is. And these are helpful, I would say, as a planning mechanism, I would say. It could well be when you're planning out sets of lessons in religious education, you might want to think about how they refer to the Catechism in particular pillars. Depends on your schemes of work, that's a different question. But it's certainly a valuable reference point for us, okay? A very valuable place to have. Again, you might want to buy a copy, or you can get an app with the Catechism on it. I'm sure you do, or a website. It's something which we would have to hand, to which we can refer, not as the only source, but as a place where we can find what we need to help us move. It's got a successor volume called the Compendium, which is a smaller version. It can fit in your bag. And it's got a version called UCAT. Who's heard of UCAT? UCAT. I've heard of it. Yes. So they're all based on this. And no doubt in years to come there'll be UCAT 2, for example, or UCAT, the new version, various ideas. And that's fine because the Catechism itself does say it's a source text and it's looking for people to develop ways in which it can be used across the church. So there is scope even for you to do things with the Catechism. But the point of the Catechism is not the book itself, but the whole tradition which it encapsulates. The whole book, the whole thing, yes. Everything, yeah, it's on the website. Yeah, it's all there. So, just to focus on one aspect. And one thing, I was having a wee chat with Justin in the car. We had a 3-hour journey from Maynooth this morning, so we talked about lots of things. One of the things we spoke about was the importance of liturgy, the importance of having a proper, nuanced understanding of what we mean as a community by liturgy, and really to think through the idea of being God-centered. The liturgy is not about us, but it's about God's grace. And I think that's important. I don't want to get too involved in the details here, but the concept of liturgy is really God searching for us, and when we come to the liturgy, to the Mass, we are coming really to give thanks to God and to receive His grace. So that makes it quite different, from an assembly in a school or some form of activity like that. There's something quite different to the liturgy from that sort of thing. And one of the areas we can consider in our own formation is how central the liturgy is to our teaching and to our own sort of faith journey. What does the liturgy mean for us? Again, through the technology we have today, we can get various apps, words which we'd never have said 10 years ago, various apps which can tell us the readings of the Mass. So we don't need to carry a big missal in our pockets or bags. We can get an app on our phone and we can follow the Mass readings. So we can do that maybe before Mass, because if you have a phone during Mass, it might distract people, obviously. But to be able to get connected, I often say to the students, and it's good to know. Well, I think it's good to know that when you hear the gospel at Mass, that same gospel has been said in countless languages across the church. So you might hear the gospel in the morning in a Mass in Sligo, but that same Mass, that same gospel will be in Buenos Aires, in Ottawa, Johannesburg, Rome, and even in Glasgow. Okay? And that gives us a sense of the universality of the church as we hear these words in our own languages, yet saying the same things. So it's not about us, it's about going there and to be given that grace to come out to truth. Now, I've used this phrase, loving the tradition. You could always change the O to an I and call it living the tradition if you want. Okay, loving and living the tradition, that seems to work. We are asked, we're invited, all of us, to enter into what's called the Catholic mind or the Catholic intellectual tradition, the Catholic educational tradition. Slightly different things here, but essentially it's the accumulated wisdom, I would say, of the people of the church since the beginning. Not just the popes, not just the bishops, but all the whole church. These ideas about education, about life, about culture, which we have access to today in many different ways. And it's to show that history is actually taking place just now. We are part of history and we are part of these traditions. You know, it's possible some of our students here are in the next couple of years going to go out and devise new and creative ways of doing religious education, which in 50 years' time, people will look back to some of you and say, ah, you made that great contribution to RE in Sligo or RE in Ireland. You're part of history. But even if you don't have your name in print, it doesn't matter, because the impact you have on Catholic children makes you part of Catholic history. You don't have to be recognised by a historian to be part of Catholic history, which that's what you're doing just now. We're all part of it. That's important. So we are part of this accumulated wisdom and tradition. So we need to, looking at the third point, can we develop, how do we develop what's called an ecclesial heart? Now, the heart's an interesting word, isn't it? We talk about the heart, and certainly when it comes to Valentine's Day, people talk about the heart, don't they? You know, there's all these card shops with hearts. And it's funny, isn't it, that we assume that one particular part of our body has got connections with romantic attachments, isn't it? The heart, but love. We don't think the kidneys are about love, do we? You know? Imagine getting a Valentine's card with a big kidney in front of it. My kidney is broken since you left me. No. My lung is bursting with sadness. No, it doesn't work. No. But we know from the heart. Yeah. Now, what happens? What's going on there? Well, the heart is often seen as this idea of the seat of love. The beating heart keeps us going. So we want to develop a heart that is human, of course, but is also very much part of Ecclesia, is the church. And by church, we refer to all the baptized. Okay, all the baptized are the church. So we are part of this tradition in Ireland, in Scotland, wherever we may come from. It's a universal Catholicos, universal tradition of church. We are part of it, and we want to develop a heart that says, yeah, I'm happy to be part of this. And that's where we are just now. So as I said previously, whether you write a book or write a scheme of work or simply are a great teacher for 30, 40 years, you're very much part of that tradition. Just to finish off, as you'll be glad to hear, piece of art. One of the great things about educating in a Catholic school and other schools is the treasury of religious art, which maybe I should have used more of in this presentation, on reflection. We have access to some wonderful pieces. Now, we've all got different tastes, right? Some like particular forms, particular artists, that's absolutely fine. What we do need to work out is how a particular piece of art can enhance what we do, and also as a way to open the door to the tradition to our young people, to show these wonderful frescoes or other types of art which have come from reflection on how the Catholic mind can enhance beauty. And we have here a reflection in paintings. It's a reflection. It's an educational reflection. The School of Athens. We can't zoom in here, but if you can, at some point in the next day, look up that painting, Raphael's School of Athens, and look at the figures that are there. Ask yourself, why is this Christian painting or painting for a Vatican museum place, 16th century, why is it zooming in on some of the great names of Greek philosophy? What's going on here? Why is Aristotle there? Why is Plato there? Okay, I think Pythagoras is there as well. So, look, go in there, find out more. And what you come to see is, look at the shape. It's a community. It's a community of learning. They are framed by they are held together in a space. A space which is presented to us with the arch. But the message coming through there is one of dialogue across and between traditions. And that lies at the heart of the church. So in a sense, that could be your homework or your coursework. And to zoom in, find out more, and just ponder just what that painting is saying. Okay, I think that's 45 minutes. That's a reasonable time to pause. I don't know if anyone has got any points or questions. Maybe if you just take a minute or two just to talk among yourselves, if you want, or do you have a question right away? Well, Thanks for the easy question. Okay, let me think what I say to that. Well, I think the phrase we hear is demographic winter of Europe. That's the phrase is used, this idea that in the UK as well, we are barely at replacement levels of population. Now, do you have an answer to that? No. And one or two of the things that have been mentioned in the past is, have we really thought through Pope Paul's teaching on humani vitae, on artificial contraception? Has that just been ignored? An issue that's often not mentioned. Just put that into the debate as well. The question of immigration. Yes, the immigrants come with different religions. Some of the strongest Catholics back home are from immigrant families. And I remember in a school many years ago, slight anecdote here, we had the family of an Indian doctor. And the class was asked what they did when they went home. And all the class said, we go home, we do our homework, we go to play, then come in, have dinner, standard things, right? The Indian girl said, I go home, I help my mother with the housework, we wait for my father coming in from hospital, a surgeon, we have dinner together, then the whole family kneels down and says the rosary. You could have heard a pin drop in that class as all the heads looked, what? And these are all Catholic children. But that was quite a normal thing for them to do. Now, that might be quite an extraordinary example, but the point was that immigration brings richness in faith. It brings people of other traditions as well. And maybe one of the things we can do with our schools on a practical level is to show that the education we have in the Catholic sector is somehow different in its expectations to the mainstreams of other schools. That we're not just focusing on the preparation for exams or work, but there's a whole cultural, human, artistic dimension, maybe an affective dimension there, which is very much part and parcel of what we are trying to do in Catholic education. But I think the point you make is fair about the challenges that brings. Yeah.
You mentioned there one of the pillars in life in Christ. See, I, as a Catholic educator, I may have all the theory, but if I am not connected into a life of Christ, I will not be bringing through passion. I could give an example of a teacher I know. One child said, Miss, we believe in Jesus because you do. So if I don't have faith as a Catholic educator, and I am, you know, I'm communicating all this, how effective am I?
It's a good question. How effective are you? Essentially, the Catholic teacher, the question would be, to go back to that, if you're hiring a teacher for a school, if you're a head teacher or principal, and you have a vacancy and you have two people on the shortlist, one you know is a committed Catholic, not sure about their classroom performance, but the other is not Catholic, but is an excellent practitioner. What do you do? You know, there's a question which many heads have to face, address on a regular basis. It's not one we all want to face. But when we consider and ponder what Christian education is about, it's about the communication of a life and a lifestyle choice and lifestyle choices. And essentially, the person who is a Catholic teacher is a Catholic and a teacher. It's the good Catholic and the good teacher becomes a good Catholic teacher. So we have to find a way, or find ways in our communities to help our teachers, young, old, middle-aged, to grow in faith, to be formed in faith. Not just as something which you might do 10 minutes at the beginning of an in-service day, for example, to be blunt, but to have pathways for staff to grow as a community, to grow individually, to understand and grow deeper into this tradition of Catholicism, to also bear in mind that if education is a work of grace, we've got to let that grace flow through us, through our holiness of life. I think that's to show this holiness through our professional expertise as well, not to separate them. That we find in our holiness through doing our work well, through being the good professional, the good colleague, the best person we can be. That's a marker of our faith life, I would hope, as well. One more.
Yes.
That'll do. That's fine.
It's more a comment than anything
okay.
else. And it's just wonderful to be in a situation where our Catholic faith is expressed so positively, mm-hmm. and you support it so beautifully. You know, we're going through an interesting time in the Catholic Church in Ireland, and as Catholics, it's almost difficult to speak positively about our faith. We're mm-hmm. almost like, who's looking? Where are we? And it's just this has been a wonderful experience for me personally.
Okay.
To be in a place that's not a church, that's a public space where there are people of all different varying opinions, but for someone to just talk so positively about being Catholic is to be commended.
Well, thanks to you. Thank you. Yeah.